On this April the 14th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. Saying it is time to end America's longest war, President Biden announcing that all U.S. troops will be removed from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year, which of course is the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Vaccine advisors with the CDC meeting earlier today to review data which led federal health officials to advise a halt on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. A U.S. Capitol Police officer has been cleared of any criminal wrongdoing for fatally shooting Air Force veteran Ashley Babbitt as she attempted to breach a set of doors deep inside the Capitol during the January 6th insurrection. Authorities determined that there was insufficient evidence to prove Babbitt's civil rights were violated and that it was reasonable for officers to believe he was firing in self-defense. Meanwhile, the now former Minnesota police officer has been charged with second-degree manslaughter in the shooting of a 20-year-old black man on Sunday, and it's day two of the defense arguments in the Derek Chauvin murder trial in Minneapolis. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House, where President Biden made it official. We talked about it yesterday here in the program. During an afternoon address announcing plans to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan nearly two decades after they first arrived following the September 11th attacks, in his remarks, he announced that he refuses to pass the responsibility of America's longest war to yet another president. He is calling for an end to the 19-year war, pledging U.S. assistance to Afghanistan and support for peace negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban. The president, by the way, delivering his remarks in the Treaty Room of the White House, the same room where President George W. Bush announced the start of the war back in 2002.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth. After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home. When I came to office, I inherited a diplomatic agreement duly negotiated between the government of the United States and the Taliban that all U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just 3 months after my inauguration. That's what we inherited, that commitment. It's perhaps not what I would have negotiated myself, but it was an agreement made by the United States government, and that means something. So in keeping with that agreement and with our national interest, the United States will begin our final withdrawal, begin it on May 1 of this year. We'll not conduct a hasty rush to the exit. We'll do it responsibly, deliberately, and safely. And we will do it in full coordination with our allies and partners, who now have more forces in Afghanistan than we do. And the Taliban should know that if they attack us as we draw down, we will defend ourselves and our partners with all the tools at our disposal. Our allies and partners have stood beside us, shoulder to shoulder in Afghanistan for almost 20 years, and we're deeply grateful for the contributions they have made to our shared mission and for the sacrifices they've borne. The plan has long been in together, out together. U.S. troops, as well as forces deployed by our NATO allies and operational partners, will be out of Afghanistan before we mark the 20th anniversary of that heinous attack on September 11th.
And following his speech, the presidential motorcade, traveling a short distance from the White House to Arlington National Cemetery, where the president paid his respects to the men and women in uniform who lost their lives in Afghanistan. Now, as you heard from his remarks, the process of our withdrawal is set to begin on May 1st, conclude by September 11th. There are an estimated 2,500 U.S. forces in that country. Former President Trump began the process of pulling out troops, but Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, critical then, and is critical of President Biden now. On Fox News last night, he warned that his decision is paving the way for yet another 9/11. And earlier today, the South Carolina Republican held a news conference.
I am heartbroken that President Biden, for political reasons, took the high-risk strategy. I felt incumbent upon me to support him if he went another way. Now I feel it's incumbent upon me to point out the perils that await us. Everything I'm about to tell you, I hope I am dead wrong. I hope that it works out. If he doesn't change his mind, and I beg you, President Biden, reevaluate this. Don't lock yourself in, because things are going to change quickly in Afghanistan for the worse. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are going to benefit very quickly from this decision. So I feel like I need to tell the American people why it is in our interest to keep a few thousand troops over there until conditions are ripe. I believe if we leave Afghanistan under the path charted by President Biden, the government will deteriorate rapidly. People will go back to their corners. The Taliban will gain strength in the south, and the central government in Kabul will lose its ability to effectively manage the country. It's tenuous already. That the Haqqani Network, a terrorist organization named by our State Department to be a terrorist organization, will reign in the east. The Northern Alliance, who are the mortal enemy of the Taliban, will reconstitute and form militias in the north. In the west, Herat, which is on the border of Iran, a major city in Afghanistan, I think the Iranians will have major influence. What do we lose by pulling out? We lose that insurance policy against another 9/11. We lose listening posts in the backyard of some of the most radical movements in the world. Afghanistan has been a platform where we can monitor what's going on in Iran and other places. We lose all that. What do we gain? We gain the idea that the war is now over and Joe Biden ended the longest war in American history. With all due respect to President Biden, you have not ended the war, you have extended it.
A process first put in place by President Donald Trump and carried out officially today by President Joe Biden, but those comments by Senator Lindsey Graham here in Washington at a news conference. Well, the Senate Intelligence Committee had a pre-scheduled hearing today, but the news on Afghanistan was a primary focus, CIA Director William Burns admitting that Washington's ability to collect intelligence and act on threats will diminish when U.S. troops leave Afghanistan. Reuters writes the following, quote, Ambassador Burns' testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee underscored a key risk inherent in Biden's decision to pull remaining U.S. forces out, given the enduring presence of al-Qaeda and the Islamic State militants in that country. His warning, reflecting some experts' concern that the departure of U.S. forces will leave U.S. intelligence officers with significantly less security, constraining their ability to collect timely information on the ground. The full story at Reuters.com. Here is the CIA director with Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine.
If, as many experts predict, the Taliban will make significant territorial gains once U.S. forces are gone, what would be the implications for U.S. interests, both regionally, here at home, and globally? And if I've directed it to the wrong person, feel free to.
Well, Senator Collins, thank you very much for the question, and thank you for your earlier kind comments. I promised in my confirmation hearing that I take very seriously ensuring that our colleagues at CIA, but also working with my partners on this panel, receive the care that they deserve, and that we get to the bottom of the question of what caused these incidents and who might have been responsible. And I look forward to staying in close touch with you on that. I know my colleagues at CIA deeply appreciate your personal commitment on this issue. With regard to Afghanistan, I'll begin and then turn to Director Haynes. I guess what I would say at the start is that, you know, I think we have to be clear-eyed about the reality, looking at the potential terrorism challenge, that both al-Qaeda and ISIS in Afghanistan remain intent on recovering the ability to attack U.S. targets, whether it's in the region, in the West, or ultimately in the homeland. After years of sustained counterterrorism pressure, the reality is that neither of them have that capacity today, and that there are terrorist groups, whether it's al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula or in other parts of the world, who represent much more serious threats today. I think it is also clear that our ability to keep that threat in Afghanistan in check from either al-Qaeda or ISIS in Afghanistan has benefited greatly from the presence of U.S. and coalition militaries on the ground and in the air, fueled by intelligence provided by the CIA and our other intelligence partners. When the time comes for the U.S. military to withdraw, the U.S. government's ability to collect and act on threats will diminish. That's simply a fact. It is also a fact, however, that after withdrawal, whenever that time comes, the CIA and all of our partners in the U.S. government will retain a suite of capabilities, some of them remaining in place, some of them that we'll generate, that can help us to anticipate and contest any rebuilding effort.
The testimony earlier today on Capitol Hill by the CIA Director, Ambassador William Burns, before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And joining us on the phone is Heather Connolly. She is Senior Vice President of CSIS. And let me go back to the President's announcement pulling U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th of this year. What's the significance of that?
Well, I mean, clearly, the U.S.'s longest war, 20 years, it is time. It has to happen on someone's watch. And it, you know, obviously contemplated under the Trump administration, but now being implemented by the Biden administration. It is closing a profound chapter in U.S. foreign and security policy. I think the challenge is we just don't know how that chapter is going to end, and it's likely to be a very, very unhappy story once U.S. forces, as well as NATO and ally-partnered countries, remove themselves in September. I think that's what everybody's been trying to avoid. They didn't want that a bad story to occur on their watch, but, you know, we have to do this.
As you might imagine, when word leaked yesterday, a number of our editorials and perspectives this morning, the Washington Post has the editorial, "The Likely Result, Disaster," concluding with this sentence: "The president has chosen the easy way out of Afghanistan, but the consequences are likely to be ugly." And also in the Washington Post, opinion columnist David Ignatius says, "What's worse than leaving? Having to go back in." Can you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, there is no easy decision here. You know, I think there could have been some options of leaving a very small special forces footprint in the country to be able to work closely with the Afghan authorities, but also to be able to pull that intelligence, make sure that you can, to the best of ability, anticipate any plots or something happening that would have direct consequences on the United States. We have in our mind, obviously, when the U.S. withdrew under the Obama administration from Iraq, we found ourselves going back at high entry costs to fight ISIS. I mean, that in some ways is what David Ignatius and others are talking about. But I think it's also another important point. There are actually more U.S. allies have more forces in Afghanistan than the United States does right now. So we were already really minimizing our posture well before this decision for complete removal. I anticipate that you will have U.S. bases and forces in the area and a much heightened state of alert, allowing for those special forces and operations, should they need to operate, to be able to go in. So this is not going to end prettily. It's for sure. But it does have to come to an end. And I think it's fitting on the 20th anniversary that it does.
And of course, safe to assume that our intelligence has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. The events that led to 9/11 in 2001 compared to where we are in 2021.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have in place now the National Counterterrorism Center, our intelligence, working closely with our allies and partners. That is absolutely the case. Just even the increase of unmanned vehicles, that type of technology, we continue to have reach into the region. But I will say the flip side of that, of 20 years of focus on the Middle East, did prevent the U.S. from recognizing the strategic competition that China and Russia were presenting to the United States because of our focus and our structural shift to that all-encompassing counterterrorism mission. So there are, you know, implications of 20 years focused in one part of the world, where now we're seeing a whole other set of strategic challenges to the United States that even our Director of National Intelligence just called China an unparalleled priority. Well, you have to adjust those resources, and now, of course, the Indo-Pacific is a great priority for the U.S.
Which is my follow-up. Let me remind our listeners, we're talking with Heather Connolly of CSIS, the president meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister on Friday. What does this tell you, and you alluded to it just a moment ago, in terms of the pivot of the Biden administration when it comes to foreign policy priorities?
Yeah, absolutely. It is very clear that the Indo-Pacific is going to consume a lot of the Biden administration's time. In fact, the first in-person visits from Secretary of State Blinken, Secretary of Defense Austin, went to the Indo-Pacific. And of course, the first in-person leader meeting for President Biden will be the Japanese Prime Minister. So there are a lot of moving parts right now, and clearly very concerned about China and the probing and testing of Taiwan's airspace. The Biden administration has now just sent a delegation of former officials, former Senator Chris Dodd, former Deputy Secretaries of State Richard Armitage, Jim Steinberg, to be able to give allies reassurance at this moment. And you're seeing that with the ministers, with the prime minister's meeting. Japan is a key ally addressing China's economic predatory behavior, but is a real pillar of stability in the Indo-Pacific. So I think you're going to see a lot more very strong outreach to allies. President Biden has made it very clear his policy is an allied-centric policy, working with our allies in the Indo-Pacific, Japan, Australia, obviously India, with the Quad, working with NATO, our European partners and allies. So it's going to be a very busy administration working closely with those partners.
Heather Connolly, her expertise includes Europe, Russia, and Asia. She is Senior Vice President for the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And by the way, some of those issues that Heather Connolly just outlined came up today with some of the country's top U.S. intelligence officials offering their assessment of worldwide threats affecting the U.S., especially cybersecurity and military concerns posed by Beijing and Moscow. It was during today's Senate Intelligence Committee they touched on the threat of both domestic and international terrorism as well. This, by the way, was the first such assessment formally presented at a hearing to Congress in 2 years, in part because of tensions between former President Trump and the nation's intelligence community. The Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, in her opening statement, repeating language outlined in yesterday's release of the annual threat assessment. She described China as, quote, a near-peer competitor challenging the U.S. in multiple arenas while pushing to revise global norms in ways that favor the authoritarian Chinese system. That from the Director of National Intelligence, who also offered this assessment of Russia and COVID-19.
And next, with respect to Russia, we assess that Moscow will continue to employ a variety of tactics to undermine U.S. influence and erode Western alliances. While Russia does not want a conflict with the United States, Russian officials have long believed that Washington is seeking to weaken Russia. And Moscow will use a range of tools to pursue its objectives, including mercenary operations, assassinations, and arms sales. It will also employ, as we've reported publicly, new weapons and cyber capabilities to threaten the United States and its allies, and seeks to use malign influence campaigns, including in the context of U.S. elections, to undermine our global standing, sow discord, and influence U.S. decision-making. Russia is becoming increasingly adept at leveraging its technical prowess to develop asymmetric options in both the military and cyber spheres in order to give itself the ability to push back and force the United States to accommodate its interests. And turning to Iran, Tehran is seeking to project power in neighboring states, deflect international pressure, minimize threats to regional stability. Iraq will be a key battleground for Iranian influence in the coming year, but Tehran will also continue to pursue a permanent military presence in Syria, destabilize Yemen, and threaten Israel. And for its part, North Korea may take aggressive and potentially destabilizing actions to reshape its security environment and will seek to drive wedges between the United States and its allies. These efforts could include the resumption of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing. When it comes to transnational threats, the assessment focuses on key issues that really intersect with the state actor threats that I've just outlined, starting with COVID-19. The effect of the current pandemic will obviously continue to strain governments and societies over the coming year, fueling humanitarian and economic crises, political unrest, and geopolitical competition as countries build influence, as countries such as China and Russia seek advantage through vaccine diplomacy to build influence, and in some cases demand accessions from other governments.
A portion of the opening statement from today's Senate Intelligence Committee and Director Haynes warning that Iran continues to create instability across the Middle East, also indicating the threat from North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile program remains very real for the U.S. and the West. Several other national security officials, along with the directors of the CIA and the FBI, also testifying before the same committee, all of it posted on our website at cspan.org. Here's more with the committee chair, Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, and the director of national intelligence.
My question is this. The idea that the IC has to become kind of that ability to look into where China is rising in a series of areas of technology development. How do we get that? How do we have that kind of appropriate oversight? I'd like you and maybe Director Burns to address this question. In many ways, this committee by default has become a little bit of the technology committee for the Senate. And again, I want to commend folks like Senator Cornyn, Senator Sass, and Senator Rubio on things like semiconductors. We're taking a lead. We're also trying to look into AI. We're looking into quantum. We're looking into all this list of rising technology areas. But how does the IC build up that expertise of being able to monitor China's rise in a variety of technology areas? If both you and Dr. Burns, if anybody else wants to jump in as well, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. So thank you, Chairman. I think I'll start and hand it over, obviously. This is an area, obviously, that you've had a lot of interest in, and I know the committee has really helped us think through, in a sense. But it is absolutely true that we are focused on this issue. We think it's incredibly important, as you've indicated. And as you note, it's not just about 5G, which obviously is one piece of the puzzle, but it's across a whole series of technology sectors where China is increasingly catching up to us, in effect, and where we see that they're contesting our leadership, in effect, in these areas. And the implications are the things that I think we can help to supply to the policy community, both the sort of pace at which they are moving, but also what are the implications for national security and what should they be focused on and prioritizing, as well as understanding, in a sense, what the implications are for supply chain and for resilience and how we can actually address these issues satisfactorily. But I think, as your question implies, it means that we need to be as smart about technology as any other part of the U.S. government and our society.
A hearing focused on national security threats facing the U.S., that from Avril Haynes. She is the Director of National Intelligence before the Senate Intel Committee. And you're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. You're listening to Washington Today for this Wednesday. It's also available as a podcast. Here are some of your political headlines. The top Republican on the House Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Kevin Brady of Texas, announcing today he will retire next year. Now in his 13th term, he was first elected back in 1996. And in North Carolina, former Republican Governor Pat McGrory is running for that state's open U.S. Senate seat with the retirement of Republican Senator Richard Burr. Pat McGrory served one term as governor before losing re-election in 2016. And in case you missed his tweet this morning, Senator Ted Cruz posting the following, quote, "Some smartass dropped off a copy of Boehner's new book at my office. It's even signed. I filed it in the appropriate place." The book was tossed in the fireplace. The former House Speaker referring to Senator Cruz as, quote, "Lucifer in the flesh." And he told the Stanford Daily earlier today that he, quote, "never worked with a more miserable SOB in my life." In other news, a federal vaccine advisory committee met earlier today to discuss next steps on Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine. It follows yesterday's news that federal health officials recommending states pause its use while agencies review six U.S. cases of a rare and severe type of brain blood clot among the more than 7 million people who received the shot. The CDC and the FDA announcing the pause was recommended so officials could further review the cases. An advisory committee looking at more answers why 6 women who were between the ages of 18 to 48 suffered the side effects. They developed symptoms 6 to 13 days after the vaccination. One recipient, a Virginia woman, died last month. Another remains in critical condition this evening. At today's White House COVID briefing held virtually, here's Dr. Rochelle Walensky with this assessment.
I do want to share with you where we are in the context of the pandemic. Yesterday, the CDC reported 61,000 new cases of COVID. As such, CDC's most recent data show the 7-day average of new cases has continued to increase, now 6% over the 7-day period, with a 7-day average of 67,530. Hospital admissions also continue to increase, the most recent 7-day average, a little over 5,400 admissions per day, is also up 6.8% from the previous 7-day period. And unfortunately, there were also 569 deaths again yesterday. Now, I want to switch topics to the decision we made yesterday to pause administration on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I have always told you I'm going to tell you the truth, and I'm going to lead with science. And today is, once again, one of those moments. CDC and FDA were alerted to 6 cases of rare types of blood clots called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis that occurred in combination with low levels of platelets, or a condition known as thrombocytopenia. 2 individuals with these blood clots also had clots in their abdominal cavity or the veins of their gastrointestinal tract. The cases were reported to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting Systems, known as VAERS, which is a system that CDC and FDA co-manage to serve as an early warning system to monitor the safety of vaccines. All 6 individuals with these clots were women between the ages of 18 and 48, and their symptoms presented 6 to 13 days after they were vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. These reports of cerebral venous sinus thrombosis and thrombocytopenia are similar to reports of thrombotic events with thrombocytopenia seen in Europe after vaccination with the AstraZeneca vaccine. In the European cases, both men and women presented with the blood clots, though they were more frequent in women.
And that's from Dr. Walensky. She is the director of the CDC. Now, just over half of the adult population in this country reporting having already received at least one COVID vaccine. Another 14% say they will get the vaccine as soon as they are allowed. But a new poll from Monmouth University says 1 in 5 Americans, 21%, claim they will never get the vaccine if they can avoid it. Dr. Anthony Fauci addressing that concern earlier today during the same briefing.
Importantly, when I go out and try to counter the issues of hesitancy, a substantial proportion of the hesitancy is centered around concern that the vaccines might not be safe. I've addressed this many times on this briefing. For example, the question, you did this so quickly. In 11 months, it usually takes years. Is there a real problem here? Did you cut corners? And did you not pay enough attention to safety? The fact that following the EUA, we have continued to follow very carefully any possibility of adverse events, I believe, is the other side of the coin of hesitancy. It should reinforce in those individuals, how we take safety so seriously. So as opposed to looking this as a negative safety issue, it could be looked at as a positive issue where they know that when we let a vaccine be available and give it a go-ahead to be put into the arms of the American people, we do it with a considerable degree of confidence as to its safety. So when I get asked questions about whether or not this has set us back from a hesitancy standpoint, I give the opposite of it, namely what I've just explained.
That assessment from today's White House COVID briefing held virtually, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Meanwhile, Moderna hopes to have a booster shot for its 2-dose COVID vaccine available sometime this fall. It was just last month that NIH began testing a variety of offerings from Moderna as a way to use a 3rd shot designed to boost immunity protection as concerns grow about these emerging variants, especially those from South Africa. The Food and Drug Administration's approach to authorizing a modified COVID vaccine is similar to the annual flu vaccines. Quite simply, that means that it could be cleared for emergency use without requiring lengthy clinical trials. And the White House Correspondents Association announcing today it was canceling its annual dinner for the second year in a row over concerns of the ongoing pandemic. In a statement, the organization's executive director, Steve Thoma, saying, quote, "We have worked through any number of scenarios over the last several months, but to put it plainly, while improving rapidly, the COVID-19 landscape is just not at a place where we could make necessary decisions to go ahead with such a large indoor event. Normally held at the Washington Hilton, the date has been set for next year, though, April 30th, 2022. Now to Minnesota, where the former police officer who shot and killed Dante Wright on Sunday has been charged with second-degree manslaughter. Kim Potter resigned from the force just yesterday. It was during a traffic stop on Sunday in Brooklyn Center, which set off days of unrest in a community already dealing with the trial of another former officer charged in the death of George Floyd. Dante Wright was pulled over during a routine traffic stop. The now former officer said she intended to use a taser to bring him under control. Instead, she shot him in the chest. Here is how that moment unfolded. That from now former police officer Kim Potter. Family members Sir Dante Wright calling his death an execution and questioned how a 26-year veteran of the police force could mistake a gun for a taser. 10 miles from Brooklyn Center in a Minneapolis courtroom, the Derek Chauvin murder trial resumed today. Among those testifying for the defense, a witness backing the contention that George Floyd died of cardiac arrest combined with illicit drugs in his body and not from a lack of oxygen while pinned to the pavement. Dr. David Fowler recently retired after 17 years as the chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland. His testimony marking the start of the cause of death phase for the defense case. He says he would have classified Floyd's manner of death as undetermined due to multiple factors. Eric Nelson is part of the defense team.
How would you classify the manner of death?
So this is one of those cases where you have so many conflicting different manners. The carbon monoxide would usually be classified as an accident, although somebody was holding him there. So some people would say you could elevate that to a homicide. You've got the drugs on board. In most circumstances, in most jurisdictions, a drug intoxication would be considered to be an accident. He's got significant natural disease, certainly the heart, paraganglionoma. You know, you can certainly consider it as a potential exacerbating process, but I wouldn't put it at the top of the list there. So he's got a mixture of that. And then he's in a situation where he's been restrained in a very stressful situation. And that increased his fight and flight type reaction, and that would, during restraint, would be considered a homicide. And you put all of those together, it's very difficult to say which of those is the most accurate. So I would fall back to undetermined
in
this particular case.
If we put your slide regarding the undetermined manner again back up. So essentially, you would agree that this had ding causes.
Correct.
And under the definition, the NAMES definition of an undetermined manner, how does that apply?
So that is what this classification under the NAME guidelines is really one of the uses of this particular classification is when you've got so many conflicting different potential mechanisms of death that could lead to so therefore the manner is not clear.
Your Honor, I have no further questions.
Day two for the defense and the testimony of Dr. David Fowler, now a retired chief medical officer for the state of Maryland in the Derek Chauvin murder trial. In case you missed any of it, it's available on our website at cspan.org. It reairs weeknights on C-SPAN 2. The Senate Judiciary Committee holding a confirmation hearing today for Kristen Clark. She is the president's nominee to lead the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. She defended her record, including college writings, when she was a student at Harvard. And Democrats say there is an urgency for her to take office to lead the team of federal prosecutors to address racial violence as well as recent police killings of unarmed people of color. Now, if confirmed, she would be the first black woman to lead the division since its inception back in 1957. There was a moment in which Senator Ted Cruz of Texas repeatedly interrupted Attorney Clark during an exchange over the issue of defunding the police. You'll also hear from the committee chairman, Senator Dick Durbin.
Last year, you wrote an op-ed in Newsweek entitled, "I Prosecuted Police Killings, Defund the Police, But Be Strategic." Do you still believe it is a good idea to defund the police?
Thank you, Senator, for that question. I do not support defunding the police. The impetus for writing that op-ed was to make clear that I do not support defunding the police. And I spend considerable time talking about the need to channel resources to places such as mental health treatment to alleviate some of the burdens that we place on the doorstep of law enforcement, some of the issues we ask them to wrestle with that are outside their core competency.
Ms. Clark, we have limited time, so let me, you say you don't support defunding the police. You just said it twice. The title of your article was Defund the Police, but let's not just look to the title. Your article begins by saying that the national protests we saw last year, quote, opened up space for transformative policy discussions. You then continue to write, "Into that space," and this is a quote, "into that space has surged a unifying call from the Black Lives Matter movement, defund the police." Do you really believe defund the police is a unifying call?
I don't support defund the police.
I'm reading from your article. Do you disagree with your article?
Amidst the demonstrations and protests, I wanted to provide a different perspective. I don't support taking away resources from police and putting communities in harm's way. There's a rise in hate crimes and extremism.
Ms. Clark, you know you're testifying under oath here.
Please allow her to.
You just said
Senator
a moment
Cruz,
ago.
Senator Cruz, please allow her to complete her answers.
Well, I'm not going to allow her to filibuster. So I'm going to ask a question. If she wants to answer the question that I asked, she can do so. But I'm not.
She should be allowed. I hope you'll show respect to the witness.
I will show respect to every witness, but we also have limited time, as you're aware. And you've been on this committee long enough to know that witnesses, in avoiding questions, will try to filibuster on different topics. So I'm going to ask questions, and I'm going to expect answers to the questions I ask. And I understand the chairman wants to jump in and defend the witnesses, but that's your prerogative to try to do so.
I will defend witnesses on either side and members on either side. We will be respectful in this committee. I hope that all members will.
I hope and expect the same standard will be applied to senators on both sides.
Just part of the exchange earlier today, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and you heard from Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois and Ted Cruz of Texas, the testimony of Kristen Clark, who, by the way, is a first-generation American. Her family emigrated from Jamaica. She previously worked in the Justice Department during the Obama administration and is the former head of New York's Civil Rights Bureau. Bernie Madoff died earlier today at the age of 82, the convicted financier pleading guilty back in 2008 to orchestrating a massive Ponzi scheme. He admitted to swindling thousands of clients out of billions of dollars in investments, and for a while, he claimed to have a, quote, Midas touch when it came to money, only to come crashing down as the markets collapsed back in 2007-2008. He wiped out family fortunes and ruined a number of leading charities. Bernie Madoff died from natural causes. He was housed in a North Carolina federal prison. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, today suggesting that the Fed would follow the same playbook it developed back in 2013 and 2014 once it decides to reverse what it calls its asset purchase program, meaning tapering off those asset purchases would come, quote, well before any interest rate increase. It was part of a virtual conversation sponsored by the Economic Club of Washington. Here's some background. Since last summer, the Fed has been buying about $80 billion in Treasury bonds and about $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities each month as a way to boost the economy and to keep the financial market conditions on an even keel. So for now, you can expect interest rates to remain low. He offered this assessment on the U.S. economy post-COVID-19.
I think the first thing to realize is that the structure of the economy is always changing. So the economy that we had back in college was one where low unemployment led to high inflation, and inflation stayed high. It's very different now. And so we have to constantly update our thinking about the way the economy actually works. Now, bringing that to the present, we're coming back to a different economy. It's not going to be the same economy as the one we left. And we don't know exactly what that will be, but we have some ideas, and we're going to be finding out, I think, here beginning now. One of them is that there'll be more working remotely. That's one thing. Another is we've talked to companies and big consulting firms who've surveyed companies, and many, many companies have spent the last year thinking about how they can use more effective technology, perhaps at the expense of the number of people that they need. So do their work with fewer people. And that's a lot of the service industry companies that have been traditionally big hirers of relatively low-skilled, low-paid people. So that's a concern, because we still have many millions of people from those jobs who were working in public-facing service sector jobs. They don't have a lot of other skills or wealth, and so we need to be thinking about what they're going to do and how are they going to find their way back to the lives and the working lives that they had. And it'll be different in other ways as well. We'll be learning about that. And we always try not to settle on one model of the economy and think, oh, we really understand this, because it's ever changing.
That from Jerome Powell. He, of course, is the chair of the Federal Reserve, the event sponsored by the Economic Club of Washington. Meanwhile, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, says the government stimulus programs have left consumers flush with savings. He says that bodes well for a stronger economic recovery. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow gaining 53 points, but the Nasdaq losing 138. The S&P also down nearly 17. And on his White House blog, one of the president's top aides and a member of the Council of Economic Advisers saying, quote, the COVID-19 pandemic has caused an unconventional recession, which is why the recovery will not be typical either. We talked with Jared Bernstein from his White House office to explain.
I think the key point there is that we really shut the whole economy down as demanded by the pandemic crisis. And that leads to a shock on the demand side and the supply side. That is, not only did millions of people lose jobs, but also lots of businesses shut down. So this was a uniquely deep recession in that regard. When you go from essentially shutting an economy down to gradually turning it back on, it's going to have different effects than the usual sort of downs and ups of the typical cycle.
So where is that $2 trillion stimulus right now? What impact is that having on the economy on the short term and in the long term?
Good question. So you're talking about the American Rescue Plan, and that money has been working its way through the economy in a variety of ways. I think one shorthand way to say it is that there are 150 million shots in arms and 150 million checks out the door. That is a huge part of the rescue plan, was to get to the other side of the crisis by producing and distributing the vaccine in ways that will ensure a more robust and reliable recovery on the other side of the crisis. There is no recovery like that without getting the virus in the rearview mirror. At the same time, with the direct impact payments out, with the child tax credits in the pipeline, and many states and localities getting the support they need to do virus control and vaccine distribution, we're setting ourselves up for the recovery that is nascent at this point.
We're talking with Jared Bernstein. He is a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. And as you know, from White House health officials, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, that lingering concern that there could be other variants, there could be yet another wave. So in terms of the economy, if that were to happen, what impact would it have?
I want to be very careful as an economist and not an epidemiologist to avoid speculating on where this is going. I think the key point is that the momentum in terms of virus control, in terms of vaccine production and distribution, was and remains strong. And you can begin to see quite clearly in the data people reengaging with commerce in a way that's going to make the next few quarters really quite robust. And in fact, every forecast I've seen is for above trend growth. We're seeing some heat in the inflation data, by the way. That's welcome in the sense that we expect there to be some price pressures again as folks reengage with commerce, and especially as we bounce back from some of the very low price levels a year ago when the pandemic first hit. But thus far, we're seeing, you know, a recovery that's proceeding in a way that I think is consistent with what the president's been trying to do.
But it sounds like what you're saying and what you've written for whitehouse.gov/briefing is that inflation for the moment is not a huge concern.
Inflation for the moment is something that we want to watch very, very closely. I think the way I would put it and the way we tried to frame it in the blog is inflation for the moment is unfolding in much the way we expected. There are a number of factors that are creating some upward pressure on prices right now. I mentioned one of them. We call them base effects, the idea that price levels fell so steeply a year ago that even if they're normalizing now, that's going to look like a big percentage change. That's sort of a statistical anomaly. But we also know that as people come back into the economy, as they reengage with commerce, there are going to be some misalignments between consumer demand and the supply side that we talked about earlier. Remember the shutting down that occurred and the reopening that's gradually occurring. That's also going to create price pressures. But the key from our perspective is that these appear to be transitory thus far. The Federal Reserve has said the same thing, and of course, they watch this very closely. And I think that's the key, differentiating between transitory effects and more permanent and lasting ones.
So bottom line, what does that mean to the pent-up demand? It's been more than a year since we basically had a lockdown in this country. As we move into the summer and fall, where does that put goods and services?
What it means is that we're going to have, if everything unfolds as we're expecting and we're seeing thus far, and there's always going to be uncertainties and some bips and bops going in surprising directions, but generally speaking, we think we're going to see considerable pent-up demand run into supply that in some cases will be temporarily misaligned. A good example would be if you think about people who've been vaccinated, they're ready to go out to have meals again in restaurants. And it used to be there were 10 restaurants in their neighborhood, and now there are 5 or 6. And that could create some bottlenecking, not unlike we've seen in the energy sector in recent months. And that creates some temporary or transitory upward pressure on prices. But those things will adjust. New restaurants will come in line. Ones that close will reopen. Workers will come back into the job market, and that will relieve some of the pressures in the labor market. And so these misalignments appear to us to thus far look transitory. It doesn't mean we won't see some price pressures, and it does mean we're going to have to monitor things very closely. But thus far, we see a robust recovery, and the administration's policies, both in terms of getting to the other side of the crisis and making sure families and businesses have help they need, as playing out, you know, much the way we expected and hoped.
Jared Bernstein, he is joining us from the White House, a member of the Council of Economic Advisors. We thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
And one note from Capitol Hill, legislation to make D.C. the 51st state advancing from the House Committee on Oversight and Reform today, paving the way for approval by the full House for the second consecutive year. That could come as early as next week. We'll have live coverage of the debate on C-SPAN. The Democratic Majority Committee voting along party lines to pass what is known as the Washington, D.C. Admission Act, blocking every Republican amendment during the markup session. Like last year, the bill is likely to face significant hurdles in the U.S. Senate because of the filibuster. The legislation needs the support of 60 senators to advance. Democrats, of course, holding 50 seats in the Senate. Vice President Harris, who does support statehood, can cast a tie-breaking vote, but not all Democratic senators have expressed their support for statehood legislation. And Queen Elizabeth II returning to her royal duties just 4 days after the death of her husband, Prince Philip. She held an in-person event just yesterday, the Queen hosting a ceremony at Windsor Castle for William Peel, who retired after serving for 14 years as the Lord Chamberlain, the most senior aide in the royal household. The funeral for Prince Philip will take place Saturday at St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. It has been scaled down in accordance with the pandemic restrictions. The chapel, which can accommodate up to 800 guests, will have a maximum of 30 in attendance. From the C-SPAN Video Library, there was this moment from nearly 30 years ago, the prince coming to Washington, D.C. in May of 1990. Enduring remarks at the National Press Club, he told this story.
We came here, I came with the Queen before she'd succeeded in President Truman's day. So it just makes you realize how old I am. And there was a splendid, because just at that time, if you remember, there's been a general election at home, and Winston Churchill had just, his party had just got back in again. And while we were here in Washington, some splendid, rather elderly lady, who I don't think quite knew what was going on, she greeted the Queen by saying, "I'm so pleased your father's been re-elected." Whereupon somebody standing next to her got really rather embarrassed, knew much better about it. He said, no, dear, that was Winston Churchill. So she turned to me, "Oh, I'm so pleased to meet you." There we go. I don't think anybody tried to explain that one away. And then you said that I was present at the Japanese surrender in Tokyo. That was splendid at the time, but it got a little embarrassing later on because we paid a state visit to Japan several years later. And, of course, a lot of people there said, "Your first visit to Japan?" And I said, "Yes." I'm not always as tactless as people make out. And you said that my sporting career was over. I have to correct you, Mary. anybody who's...
Some good humor from Prince Philip at the National Press Club. That was May 18th of 1990. And just one of the many items on the C-SPAN Video Library at cspan.org. Of course, a member of the British royal family. He died last Friday. Prince Philip was 99 years old. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully in Washington for the Wednesday edition. Hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.